Okay, and again, digressions are, okay, whatever, I don't want to repeat, okay. And again, I apologize for being a little upset, but as I say, it is very, very difficult, if a person has a certain derech in teaching, it is very, very difficult to expect a person to change. It can be done, and again, the whole paradigm of tshuva is based on changing, obviously that's so, but still, every person has their chelik in Torah, and Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko, which is the way you teach a student according to his derech, also means that every student eventually becomes a teacher, and the teacher also has a derech and the like. All right, so let me finish. I'll try to just to spend 15 minutes finishing the third school of Musar, and then we will try to begin a pasuk today. I was talking about the three Talmidim of Yisrael Salanter, the three altars, the three old men. We talked about Kelim and we talked about Slobodka. And the dominant idea of Kelim was self-discipline, self-mastery, understanding yourself, and trying to achieve serenity and calmness in the middle of stress. That was the idea of Kelim, and he had all sorts of exercises where you had to wake up in the middle of the night and get ready for a 5-minute learning session. When after a fast they gave you food of fish with bones so you'd eat slowly and not grab. When you got a letter from home, you had to wait 24 hours till you opened it up. If there was a loud noise in back of you, you didn't turn around during davening. All of this was serenity, calmness. The altar of Simcha Zissel very much believed that when we are anxious, when we rush, you know, this is what military surgeons say, you know, combat surgeons, when they have to repair an artery. So they'll often tell, the saying in the combat area is, it takes 2 minutes to do the suture if you don't rush. If you rush, you'll mess up, it'll take longer. Take your time. Think before you act. This was the shita of the altar of Kelim. This was his dominant approach to moral and spiritual growth. The altar of Slobodka, who was initially a Talmud of Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelim, the altar of Slobodka, emphasized, again, these are not exclusive, but I'm talking about emphasized the idea of Gadlus HaAdam, the greatness of a human being, the fact that you're in the image of God, and therefore you have dignity, you are deserving of respect, as is every other human being. And therefore, how can you sin? You're besmirching something beautiful and precious, and you're putting it into the garbage. And therefore, his orus, his arousal for Musar, was based not on a feeling, I'm garbage. In other words, sometimes you say Musar, we sometimes think, oh, you're no good, I'm no good. The other way around. You're so great, how can you possibly do something that detracts from the glory that is within your personality? And it is said that the Altar of Slobodka first heard this thought from Rav Simcha Zissel, the very first shmooze he heard in Kelim, and that was the one that imprinted itself on his personality, and that became his dominant approach for 50 years. Now, as a result, in Slobodka, which was, again, maybe I'm biased, because so many of the American Gedolim came from Slobodka. Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov Ruderman, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, many, many more. Rabbi Miller went to Slobodka, that's correct. So Slobodka emphasized individuality and greatness. Now because of this, there's an interesting dichotomy in Slobodka. Slobodka produced the greatest Gedolim, and Slobodka produced a not insignificant share of Apikorsim and heretics. Because you understand the risk, and this is a risk that exists in our Chinuch today. If you emphasize individuality, creativity, finding your niche, developing your talent, you're opening up a dangerous pathway. Because on one hand, you can encourage the greatness of those who will grow in Torah. On the other hand, if everybody's doing their own thing, they wander off. Meaning, one of the difficulties we have in chinuch and even in raising children is to what degree do you kind of have a rigid structure that may create predictability. You kind of cookie cutter. You know what you're getting, so to speak, even though that often breaks down too, versus encouraging people to grow as individuals. Slobodka was the great yeshiva in which people were encouraged to grow as individuals. But in that growth, there was a danger. You produce the pinnacle of greatness, and you produce sometimes the opposite. Meaning people who became great, great professors, great philosophers, great scientists. Again, if they remained observant, that's perfectly fine too, but often leaving Yiddishkeit, as it were, leaving Torah, because they went their own way. The Altar of Slobodka had almost an uncommon ability to assess a person's character upon first meeting. He could, I mean, the way Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky describes it, he could meet a boy, an 18-year-old boy, and kind of know what that person is going to be 30 years from then. This person is Rosh Hashiva, this person will be a posek, this person will be a professor, this person will be an apikoros. He had this sense, and almost always he was right on the mark. He just understood. He had a phenomenal understanding of human nature, almost a miraculous understanding. In fact, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say, Hasidim say, why don't Litvaks have like a Hasidish Rebbe? He says, we had the equivalent of a Hasidish Rebbe. This was the Altar of Slobodka. The Altar of Slobodka was not a Rosh Hashiva. He did not give shir. He was not even a regular mashgiach, so to speak. He didn't even give the Musar Shmuzim that often. But he was the spiritual presence behind everything. He often tried to conceal his own great Torah knowledge, although it was said that he knew Shas by heart. But he never, no one ever saw him learning almost, like he was... He was kind of very much a hidden person and the like. And eventually he came to Eretz Yisrael and he died in Eretz Yisrael. In B'nai Barat, the yeshiva of Hebron is the Israeli branch of the Slobodka yeshiva in Europe. And that moved already in the 1920s, and that was unfortunately the great massacre in Hebron, which caused the yeshiva to go to Yerushalayim. And then in B'nai Barak, there's a yeshiva of Slobodka. That was the Slobodka yeshiva in Europe that was destroyed in the Holocaust. So in a sense, both Hebron in Yerushalayim and Slobodka in B'nai Barak are both the heirs of the yeshiva of Slobodka in Lithuania. But Hebron was a branch that existed while there still was a Slobodka yeshiva in Europe. The Slobodka of B'nai Barak is after the war. That is the later survivor. And as I say, the Altar of Slobodka was extraordinary in that way, and often his teachings were paradoxical. He would often contradict himself. He would tell one student one thing, one student another thing, because of Chanoch Lenar al Pi Darko. There were times in which he was very, very kind, and there were times that he was very strict, and in fact, people, if he loved you and cared about you and thought you had potential, he would give you very, very strong mussar. If he thought you didn't have potential, he was very nice to you and didn't say anything. So, and often, if he felt you were not good that week, the strongest mussar he gave you was not saying a thing. So guys would go over to him, and they would say, Rebbe, I was late for davening today. I was late for Seder today. Does the Rebbe want to tell me something about it? And the Alter would say, that's fine, have a good day. And that would be the most painful musser that existed. There were times in which he wouldn't give musser until 10 years after an event happened. A story that the Alter would decide who would get aliyos every Shabbos. And apparently this was a big deal, meaning to say, Shlishi is traditionally the most important aliyah. So if a relatively minor person got Shlishi, then anyone else who got an aliyah that week knew that they were not in the altar's good graces. They measured it based on Shlishi. So once a very, very chashuv person got the fourth aliyah, which in the hierarchy of aliyahs, although the Rush says we're not supposed to measure aliyahs, but the Rush says, some people say Ravi is like the least significant aliyah. So somebody got Ravi, who was a very chashuv person, and he went to the altar and said, what did I do wrong? Like, what's the musar here? The altar says, don't you remember 10 years ago? Don't you remember what happened? He says, no, what happened? He says, a man came into the Beis Medrash Shabbos morning, and he took off his jacket as if to put on tefillin, like your automatic pilot, and I saw you smile. You were getting pleasure in somebody else's embarrassment. I didn't bring it up then because you were too young to appreciate how serious that is. But now you're old and mature enough to understand what it's like to get pleasure in somebody else's embarrassment. This was... Well, Shlishi is the first aliyah that a non-Kohen or Levi can get. So therefore it was reserved normally for the most chashuv non-Kohen Levi, Talmud Chacham, and the like. Now, the Rush made a point. The Rush did make a point that we are not supposed to grade aliyahs, and he made a point that he wanted to get Revi every Shabbos. So people shouldn't make that difference. But still, in the world, we commonly have this hierarchy. This is the altar of Slobodka. Now let me mention the third disciple. The third altar was the altar of Nevardik. Now the altar of Nevardik, his name was Rav Yosef Yozo Horvitz. He was very, very young when he met Rav Yisrael Salanter, but he did have some influence from Rav Yisrael. He also was influenced by the altar of Kelim, and he was also influenced by the altar of Slobodka. So he was both a Talmud of Rav Yisrael and a Talmud of the other two. So he was the youngest of all of them. His story is very interesting. He is also the most extreme of all of them. Nevardik. The altar of Nevardik became an orphan at around the age of 15. And he was supporting his family. He had many brothers and sisters when his parents died. And he was supporting his family at the age of 15. There were no child labor laws in Europe at the time. And one time he meets Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And Rav Yisrael Salanter saw that this was an intelligent person, a bright person, and he says, "What do you do with your time?" And the boy says, "I have to make a living. I have to worry about a living." He says, and Rav Yisrael said to him, "And don't you worry about dying? Do you worry about what's going to be when you die? What are you going to bring to Hashem?" And those words created somehow an epiphany within this young boy's mind. He immediately somehow arranged an alternative way for his family to be supported. He did not abandon them. And he devoted himself to learning and Torah study. He became a great, great Talmud Chacham. He married young. But at some point after his wife died, I'm going a few years ahead, he did a very extreme thing. He decided he wanted to be a hermit and separate himself from the world. But how did he want to separate himself? He literally bricked himself into a house in which all of the doors were shut. He could not leave the house. He locked himself into a house. And there were two holes in the wall. People would bring him food. One hole was milchik food. One hole was fleishik food because he really didn't pay attention. And he was called Rav Yosef Bal HaChorim, Rav Yosef of the holes, because there were the two holes. And he stayed there for 2 years, 2.5 years. And many people thought he was absolutely crazy. They thought he was nuts. They went to the famous Rav of the city, who was the Orach HaShulchan, the Rav of Nevardik, one of the greatest poskim. And they demanded that they smash down the building and take him out. And the Orach HaShulchan said, "This is what he's doing is not our derech, certainly. But he is a great, great tzaddik and kadosh. Leave him alone." After 2.5 years, he was widowed at this point. He did not have a wife or children that he needed to raise. But after this point, what did he do for the 2.5 years? Well, obviously, he learned Torah, he davened, but remember, he didn't go to a minyan for all of those years. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, I guess he had a shofar with him, I don't know exactly what everything was, how he did everything. But after 2.5 years, he came out, and he then proceeded to establish 125 yeshivas throughout the breadth of Poland and later into Stalinist Russia as well. And it was just amazing. I guess after 2 years, you have a lot of pent-up energy. And he went out, and he created the worldwide network, which are called the Nevardiker yeshivas. The Stipler was a Talmud of the altar of Nevardik, the Stipler, and he's a Nevardiker, as it were. Now, what was unique about Nevardik? If Kelim stressed serenity, calmness, the altar of Slobodka stressed greatness and individuality. The Elder of Nevardik stressed the idea of unconditional emuna in Hashem. That his point was, there is no such thing as ever asking yourself the question, can something be done? You simply ask yourself the question, should it be done? If it should be done, you try to do it, regardless of whether you think you'll be successful. And if you have emuna, Hashem will give you supernatural abilities. Now, the Chazon Ish was critical of this, actually. The Chazon Ish says, emuna does not mean God will give your efforts success. It means whatever happens is gamzul tova. But the Alter of Nevardik was very, very extreme in his level of emuna. And as a result, if Rav Simcha Zissel kind of cultivated a very urbane, gentleman type of Ben Torah, dressed well, was neat and clean, dignified, had a dog, had a cane. The whole idea was dignity, and the Alter of Slobodka kind of the same way because of Godless Adam. In Nevardik, there was a certain streak of wildness. There was a certain streak of indifference to chitzonius, that the physical world was nothing and worthless. And all that matters was Avodas Hashem. And you go ahead and you do it, no matter whether people laugh at you or they think you're foolish. So, to give you an example, if Rav Simcha Zissel had exercises like having to get up in the middle of the night to train yourself to use your time wisely, the Alter of Nevardik wanted to train people in not being embarrassed to do the right thing. We're embarrassed. So he said he would send his students into, let's say, a makolet, the grocery store, and ask for nails. Yeah. Or go into a hardware store and ask for bread. Because he wanted them to know what it's like to feel embarrassed and then not let it bother them. And the like. Kind of this extreme thing. To give you an example, Nevardik did have a worldwide system of yeshivas, which lasted until the Holocaust. Even today, there are Nevardiker yeshivas, not so many. And the truth is, the Nevardiker yeshivas are adulterated. They're not quite as unique and distinct as they were. They've become mainstreamed a little bit. But Nevardik was a very, very extreme. That's why to this day, without getting too personal, the Kanievsky family have a certain indifference to externals. And, you know, how do I say this delicately? Meaning to say, they're not as externally urbane as, you know, you might expect a Rav Huttner or Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was, because there's kind of an indifference to the externalities of the world, because that's not important. That was a Yerusha from the Alter of Nevardik. There was a big, I think there still is, a big Nevardik yeshiva in France. And for many, many years, he's not alive anymore, the Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Gershon Liebman. And he used to come to the United States to collect money for his yeshiva. But the problem is, he had a big problem as a fundraiser. He could not stand the sight of money. Money made him sick. He knew he had to collect it, but he saw in money the root of evil, the root of Yetzer Hara, the root of Taiva, the fact that so many people give up their spiritual ideals because they want money. So he used to vomit. It made him wretch. So he had to have a person go with him to take the money. I mean, he needed the money, but he couldn't physically even touch it. So the story goes that he once showed up at Kennedy Airport, then it was called Idlewild Airport, a long time ago. And he would not take money with him for the trip. Like, how would he take a cab? How would he go to where he had to go? So he just came penniless, nothing on him at all. And there happened to be a former student that met him in the airport. And the student said, "Can I give the Rosh Yeshiva a ride?" He says, "Yes, you can. I appreciate it." So they're driving, and the student doesn't know how to raise the question, but he says, "You know, Rebbe, I just want to ask you, what would have been if I wouldn't be here?" And the Rebbe said, "But you're here, aren't you?" That was the idea of bitachon. Again, the Chazon Ish criticizes this. The Chazon Ish says that you have to do ishtadlus. But in the Vardik, they kind of said, things will work out. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to make things work out. Again, I want to point out that in the years of Stalinist Russia, right, the years of Stalinist Russia, where to teach Torah publicly, you could be sent to Siberia or executed. The two kolchos that kept Yiddishkeit alive in Russia were Chabad. And again, we have to give them credit. The Friedeker Rebbe was very, very courageous in spreading Torah. And Novardik. Novardik continued it as well. Breslov in a much smaller way, because there were fewer Breslovers. But Chabad and Novardik were the two primary kochos that spread Torah. Yeah.
And the Friedeker Rebbe took a beating.
Yes, he did. He did. He did. In fact, there's a very...
Volunteer.
That's right. There's a very famous story that during a Purim Suda, the Friedeker Rebbe started talking about, you know, there were a lot of Jews who were informers to the Communist Party. What do they call Yev something? I don't remember the word. But these were like Jews who were communists who would inform. What is it called? Yevsexius? Yeah. So the Rebbe started talking about how we have to continue chinuch. We cannot allow communism to destroy Torah. So people were telling the Rebbe, you know, there are people in the room. You know, you don't want to be saying these things in front of these people. So the Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe, opened his shirt. He opened his shirt. And he said, "You can kill me now." He looked at them straight. He said, "You can kill me now. I am not going to stop teaching this message." And another time he was called in for interrogation by the KGB or whatever it was called then. It went through many different names. Now Putin is a big cover of Chabad, but Putin was the head of the KGB for many years. And at some point, it sounds like a bad movie line, the interrogator pulled out a gun and said, now he wanted the Rebbe to reveal who was teaching, his teachers. And the Rebbe would not reveal. So the person pulls out a gun and says, "This little thing can make a lot of people talk." Sounds like, a movie line. And the Rebbe said, "Guns scare people who believe there are many gods and only one world. But if you believe there's one God and two worlds, Olam Haba, the gun does not scare me." So the Friedrich Rebbe was a very extraordinarily courageous person. That's very true. But Novardik was side by side. Novardik, of course, was non-Hasidic. But it was Novardik and Chabad that kept Yiddishkeit alive in Russia. Now, Chabad did last a little longer simply because Novardik was almost totally wiped out in the Holocaust. More Chabad managed to survive. So this is the altar of Novardik. There's a story they tell about the altar of Novardik. I'll give you another example of the story, that there was a man who was very rich, but never gave tzedakah. So the altar of Novardik somehow got donations from him. So another Rosh Hashiva asked the altar of Novardik, he says, "What's your secret? Why are you able to get so much money out of this person?" So the altar of Novardik said, "I'll tell you the difference between you and me. You come in and you're such in awe of the person's wealth. You wipe your shoes to get the mud. You don't sit down on the couch because of the seat covers or whatever it is. You're tiptoeing around. So you're communicating to the guy, your wealth is so precious, your wealth is so wonderful. You then ask the guy to give you some of it? People don't want to give up that which is so precious and wonderful. I come in the other way." I'm not sure if it's really true. "I come in, I track mud into the house, I sit on his couch, I put my feet on the table. I communicate to the person, your wealth is garbage, it's worthless, but I'm making you an offer that you can use it for something that would be good and wonderful. So I'm offering something he'll be getting. I'm not asking him to give, I'm asking him to take. People are happy to take, right?" So that's what he said. He says that the physicality of the world is worthless unless it's used for Kedusha. So we have these three facets of Rebbe Yisrael. Now, these are not mutually exclusive. We have the emphasis on serenity and discipline. We have the emphasis on creativity and individuality. And we have the emphasis on faith and fearlessness. Not to be afraid. The famous song, Ha'ikar Lo Lefachei Klal, which is actually from Rav Nachman of Breslov, could equally be appropriated as the model of Novardik, not to be afraid. If any of you have ever read the Yiddish, it's translated into English, the Yiddish novelist Chaim Grada, you will see, you know, he disguises things very thinly, but you will see that the Musar personalities he portrays are Novardikers. And he portrays them in very vivid colors, as a novelist would, kind of extreme. But the vivid portrayal is not far off the mark. It is a fairly accurate portrayal. Also, by the way, This is the best portrayal of the Chazon Ish that appears. Chaim Grada, who was not religious at all, he married a guy. Very not religious. But he grew up in Vilna. He was orphaned. He lost his father as a young age. His mother tried to get him a tutor who would learn with him a few hours a day. And the tutor that she found was a young married man, Rav Avram Yishayo Karelitz, the Chazon Ish. And he was tutored by the Chazon Ish was a young man for around 5 years. And I think just to show you what true gedolim, godless is, in spite of the fact that Chaim Grada obviously did not keep the Torah at all, so you might think he would say bad thing, he had unbridled admiration for the Chazon Ish. So in a sense, what he says about the Chazon Ish is actually more valuable than what you might hear from a mainstream Haredi, because here is somebody totally chutz l'machaneh who saw the Chazon Ish as a great, great, great gadol. Now the Chazon Ish is portrayed in fiction. The Chazon Ish is not mentioned by name, but everybody knows he's writing about a certain tzaddik. What is it called? Rav Avram of Kosovo. Now the Chazon Ish was Avram Yishayo from Kosovo. So it's very clear that he's writing about the Chazon Ish, and that character comes across in an extremely positive way. So many say that the best biography of the Chazon Ish, in terms of the personality, is Chaim Grada's fictional novel. Okay? Yeah. Chaim Grada is G-R-A-D-E, like the word grade. Chaim Grada. Very excellent. In fact, he has another novella about Rav Chaim Ozer, which is, again, everything is disguised, but if you know the history, he knew Vilna. He was a child of Vilna. He knew everything about Vilna, and he was able to explore the ins and outs. Yeah.
Are his books translated into English?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. The Yeshiva is one of them, and then he has the Aguna. He has a number of books. Samach Atlas is about both Nevardik and the Chazon Ish. In other words, he portrays this big machlokes in Nevardik and the Chazon Ish regarding what is Emunah. Nevardik basically said, if you have enough Emunah, you'll get everything. The Chazon Ish says, no, Emunah means you accept that whatever God does is good, but that doesn't mean you can say, I'll get a specific thing, and the like. Okay. Now, B'kitzur, let me just mention two more students. So the three altars were the main ones. I mentioned two other personalities you need to be aware of. One is a man called Rav Yitzchak Blazer. Rav Yitzchak Blazer, some pronounce it. He, for a while, was the Rav of St. Petersburg, which was the Tsarist capital of Russia, and that is why he is known in Yiddish affectionally as Rav Itzel Petcherberger. Itzel is a Yiddish Yitzchak Petcherberger from St. Petersburg. But then he retired, he didn't like the rabbinate, and he just became a private citizen in Slobodka. After he left, and he eventually died in Eretz Yisrael. He died in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim, in the early 1900s. After he left the Rabbanut, for most of his life, he remained a private citizen, very, very nister, very, very concealed. He was not a Rebbe in Slobodka, but he was around the yeshiva, and Bacharim would go to him for guidance, and once in a while, the altar would have him give a Musar Shmuz. He was very close to the altar of Slobodka. The reason why Rav Itzel Petcherberger is so important is he is the one who transmitted Rav Yisrael Salanter's teachings through writing. The Sefer that you might have heard of, Or Li Yisrael is a collection of Rav Yisrael Salanter's letters augmented with various sichos and maisim that Rav Yitzel Petcherberger put together, his own insights. And Rav Yitzel Petcherberger was the disseminator in writing of Rav Yisrael Salanter's teachings. Very extraordinarily important, because although the other Talmidim were primarily with students, writing was his particular medium, although he had great, great influence on the people that he met. A tremendous, tremendous tzaddik and a tremendous humble person. You know, one of the Gedolei Ador was the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's father, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And since Petersburg was the capital of Tsarist Russia, so whenever Rabbanim had to negotiate with the Tsar and with the government, they would come to St. Petersburg, as it was called, and Rav Itzel Petcherberger, when he was Rav, had to host them. So when you have a bunch of great, great Rabbanim who come together, and they have business to talk about, but they would also talk in learning. And the Beis Levi would ask brilliant kashas, and all the Rabbanim would give their answers. And Rav Issel Petterberger kept quiet. He didn't say anything. He just sat. And the Beis Levi was a little surprised. I mean, the Rav of Petersburg is not a Talmud Chacham. He doesn't discuss things. He can't contribute to Torah learning. Now, Rav Issel Petterberger did publish a sefer in Halacha called Pri Yitzchak. And the Beis Levi said, I want to see what type of person is this. He took the sefer. He saw in one of the simanim that Rav Issel Petterberger asked the Beis Levi's question, and he gave the Beis Levi's answer, and he refuted the Beis Levi's answer, and he gave an answer of his own. But not, you know, just on his own he did this. That indeed he was a Talmud Chacham up there with everybody else, but he felt he didn't have a reason to show off in a crowd. The final Talmud, who was a very, very close, dear friend of Rav Issel Petterberger, they lived together in Slobodka and in Eretz Yisrael later, was a man by the somewhat of strange name, Rav Naftali Amsterdam, although he was not from Amsterdam. That was the family name. I guess the family came from Amsterdam. And he, for a short time, was a Rav in Helsinki, Finland, of all places. But eventually he retired to become a baker in Slobodka. He just wanted to be a baker of bread. That's how he made his parnassa. And he refused to take any positions after that Rabbanus. He was, as he defined himself, a simple baker. But he was known as a very, very miyuchad tzaddik. He would always ask to have a chavrusa with the boys in Slobodka, the great Elohim in Slobodka. But he would not allow them, although he was in his 70s, he would not allow them to bring a sefer to him. He said, I'm not allowed to use a Talmud Chacham to help me at all. He would insist on taking care of himself in all ways. And these two were spiritual presences in the Slobodka Yeshiva. So the altar of Slobodka was augmented at least by these two other presences, Rav Issel Petterberger and Rav Naftali Amsterdam. Right? So this is the this is kind of the Musar movement as we have it. And as I say, it was continued. Most of the Bali Musar who came afterwards were students of Rav Simcha Zissel. This includes Rav Yeruchim Levavitz, who was the great, great Mashgiach of Mir, Rav Yechazkel Levenstein, who was also the Mashgiach of Mir, and then Panovich, Rav Elio Dessler, the Michtav Mielio, came from Kelim, as it were, Rav Elio Lapian came from Kelim, right? These are all the disciples of the great Bali Musar.
My great uncle was
Rav
Yaffin. He was the
Rosh Hashiva
Beit Yosef.
That's correct.
Yosef is.
I should have mentioned. Rav Ram Yaffin was the altar of Navardik's son-in-law.
The son-in-law.
That's
so
exactly
Rav
right.
Horowitz did have children.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He did have children. Yeah.
So
but
I used to go.
Yeah.
Oh, God. 40 years ago, I used to go to
their
house.
Yeah. Rav Ram Yaffin.
Right.
Wow. Great success. In fact, the Stipler's main Rebbe was Rav Ram Yaffin. Because Rav Ram Yaffin was already the Rosh Hashiva when the Stipler, right? The altar of Navardik was not an active Rosh Hashiva. He was collecting money. He was running on establishing yeshivas. He did not run any individual yeshiva on a day-to-day. Beis Yosef is named after, of course, the altar of Navardik. That's right. Well,
but
great.
My grandfather was a kosher baker in Durham, North Carolina.
So there's a cross reference. Yeah. Well, Baruch Hashem, you know, Baruch Hashem, so you know firsthand what Navardik was, and very, very special and the like. If you know the Nekritz family, is also from the Navardik. In fact, Rav Naftali Kaplan, his wife is from the Nekritz family, so there are.
My daughter was a pair.
A pair is Navardik, right? Shoshana Pair is from Navardik. That's correct. No, this is Rav. I don't know if you know. Rav Naftali Kaplan is a very, very venerable Mashgiach and Baal Musar in Yerushalayim, and his wife is from the Navardik family. Yeah, and the like. Okay, he was a Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael 50 years ago, but he's been in Eretz Yisrael for many years at this point. So these are the personalities to keep in mind. I just want to mention an interesting thing. I heard from my own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Ruderman, who was very, very close as a boy to the altar of Slobodka, going all the way back, that Rav Yeruchim Lubavitz, and I'm sure you've heard of this name. He was the Mashgiach of Mir before World War II. Rav Chaskel took over in the war. Rav Yeruchim Lubavitz was probably the greatest Mashgiach in Europe. In other words, he had tremendous influence on people. He was charismatic. He inspired them. Rav Volba was a Talmud of Rav Yeruchim. And Rav Volba described, Rav Volba came from Germany. Rav Volba was actually, although we're not 100% sure, but many assume he was a Baal Tshuva. His own family was not even from. We're not entirely sure, but certainly they were modern. They were not in the yeshiva world. And Rav Volba came to Mir. He went to Mir from Germany, which was not so common. It was like coming from America almost. The distance wasn't great, but the spiritual distance was quite great. And when he comes as a boy to the Mir Yeshiva, a man introduces himself who looks like he's 30 years old. And the man says, "How old do you think I am?" And the man, Rav Volba, says, "I don't know, you look 25, 26, 30, I don't know." He says, "Nope, I'm only 3 years old." He says, "What do you mean you're only 3 years old?" He says, "It's been 3 years since I met Rav Yeruchim. And that's when I was born. My life began." Rav Volba recounted, and Rav Volba said, "And I will say the same thing about myself." This is what he said. So, I heard from my own Rosh Yeshiva that Rav Yeruchim, in spite of his greatness as maybe the greatest Mashgiach in Europe, he would go to visit the Altar of Slobodka to learn from the Altar of Slobodka. And the Altar, so my Rosh Yeshiva remembers as a boy hearing the Altar of Slobodka screaming at Rav Yeruchim and saying, You and your charisma. You want to make everybody like you. You want to make everybody imitate you. You want to make everybody follow you. What about their individuality? Don't you care about them becoming different and unique? You want everybody to be like you." And the yeshiva said, if he would speak to any boy in the yeshiva the way the Altar Zlatka was speaking to Rav Yeruchim, the boy would walk out. And Rav Yeruchim is makabel the musar. Rav Yeruchim is makabel. The Rebbe's right. The Rebbe's right. The Rebbe's right. And then later, Rav Yeruchim is honored to give a shmuz to the whole yeshiva. And as he does so, the Altar of Slobodka is sitting and crying. And somebody said to the Altar, "But you were so critical of Rav Yeruchim, and now you're hearing his shmuzim and learning." He says, "What does one thing have to do with the other?" Again, it goes back with the idea that Rav Yeruchim was strong enough to take real musar. And therefore I gave it to him. But it's only because he's so great that I could talk to him that way. And he is great. And I'll learn from him. This was the idea. So these are complicated personalities because you can't really define them in one way. And that's why the Chazon Ish once said, the Chazon Ish was against a lot of the Musar movement. He thought it was too extreme. He thought it was too obsessive compulsive. There was a certain OCD idea in which you're always examining yourself no matter what. So he felt that for certain types of personalities, it could be unhealthy and it could be destructive. But the Chazon Ish said, "I'm against Musar, the Musar movement, but I'm more against the opponents of the Musar movement." Meaning to say, the Musar movement are tzaddikim, gaonim, truly, truly righteous people. Those who oppose are sometimes doing it not l'shem shemayim, etc. But the Chazon Ish said it may not be the right approach for everybody, but you cannot deny the greatness of the people that were doing it. Those of you, if any of you ever had, either you, yourself directly or perhaps your husband or ever had the schuss to know Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner too was this very enigmatic personality, full of contradictions, full of inconsistencies. One day this, one day that. It's directly the Altar of Slobodka. The Altar of Slobodka in particular was the man of mystery in which every situation was a different situation and there was a constant readjustment of things and the like. Okay, so these are complicated personalities, but they all come from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Okay. All right, so I did finish the introduction, and again I apologize if this took longer than I thought. It did take longer than I thought. Next week, I want you to look really at two psukim, which is still an introduction, but it's going to be a textual introduction to both Mishlei and the Vilna Gaon's commentary. The two psukim are relatively simple. One is Perek Gimel. I'll just introduce the pasuk. Perek Gimel is the Rambam writes in the Mishneh Torah that this is a yesod that the whole Torah depends upon, and this is Perek Gimel pasuk Vav. B'chol Jiracheha Da'ehu. Know Hashem in all of your ways. Actually, he doesn't say Hashem. If you read it literally, know Him in all your ways. Vahu, and He, Yiyasher or Chosecha, will straighten out the paths in which you need to walk. So note, right at the outset, there are two different words for ways and paths. There is derachim, and there is orchos. And what does the pasuk mean anyway? Know Hashem in all your ways, and He will straighten out your pathways, or your paths. That's the first pasuk. And the sister pasuk is all the way in Perek Yutes, chapter 19, verse 14, Pasuk Yudalit. Bayis Vahon Nachalas Avos. A house and wealth are the inheritance you can get from your forefathers. My forefathers can leave me a big house and a lot of wealth. Umei Hashem Isha Maskelas. But a discerning, wise wife only comes from God. Mommy and daddy cannot buy a husband, a good wife. That comes from God. Again, lefi pshuto, these psukim are perfectly understandable, even on a simple level, and the simple level is not incorrect.
Could you just repeat
the
second one?
Yeah, the second one says, a house and wealth can be an inheritance from your forefathers. But only from God will you get a discerning wife. Now again, lefi pshuto, it's once again emphasizing the idea that the greatest gift that Hashem can give a man is a wife that will be his ezer kenegdo. And of course everybody knows the most famous part of Mishle is exactly the last chapter of Mishle, which is Eshet Chayil. Right, so this is a foreshadowing of the Eshet Chayil. But the reason I chose these two psukim, again, if you have a chance to look at the Vilna Gaon's commentary, you can give it a look, is that the Vilna Gaon will take these two verses and he's going to interweave them in a very, very complex and beautiful interplay and dialogue between these two verses. And you'll see an example of how a pasuk that is very beautiful even on the surface can have all sorts of unusual meaning. Okay, so next week in Mitzvah Shem, we will look at those two psukim, and then we'll start from chapter Perek Aleph. And